One of the longest trips that I can document historically was about 130 miles. It was done in a single day. And he was carrying mail. This was in the 1880s. And he was traveling basically from a couple of church missions back to, I think it was in the Calgary area. But he had considerable incentive to finish that trip as quickly as possible because he wanted to be back for his sister's wedding. And the reason that the wedding was so important to him was because they were actually going to have alcohol that they could serve. And the poor guy hadn't had a drink in quite a long time because Hudson's Bay Company was actually very stingy with alcohol at that time.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us on the Mushing Podcast. Today's episode goes all the way back to 2017. This is one of the early episodes where we really started diving into interviewing guests. His name is Tom Swan of Alaska. He is an old school mushing historian. The audio quality is a little bit different, but back then there were so many cool stories. We want to try something new here in the off season and go back and visit some of the really fun stuff. Consider it a blast from the past. It is fun to see what a difference almost 8 years of podcasting makes. Developments in technology, particularly with guest recording, has vastly improved. Let's dive in.
And today, joining us, calling in from the Fairbanks area of Alaska, his name is Tom Swan. Tom, how's it going?
It's going well.
Thanks for being on the show today. And how is the weather up in the Two Rivers area?
Well, winter is finally coming. We're starting to see some snow stick to the ground, and everyone's excited to get out on the trails.
Excellent. Tom, could you introduce yourself a little bit before we jump in? I know you like to go by the name Swanee, is that right?
Yes. Most of my friends and most of my mushing contacts know me as Swanee. It's a nickname based on my last name, and it sticks, it fits.
Right, right. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Tom, or Swanee, should I say.
Well, I'm a little bit older than most dog mushers. I'm about 63 years old. I'm a recreational dog musher. I have 19 dogs in the yard, which is a pretty small kennel by Two Rivers standards. I'm a historical reenactor, and the types of dogs that I prefer are as similar to the 19th century sled dogs as I can find.
So you mentioned you had a relatively small yard with 19 dogs. How long have you been involved with mushing, and where did you get your first dogs from when you got started?
Well, I've been mushing dogs about 11 years now. I've been interested for a long time, probably for 25 or 30 years. But I really wasn't in a position to put together a team or a kennel until about 2005 or so. And I think the thing that set the hook was a buddy of mine by the name of Mike Green, who used to live in Two Rivers and is a longtime New England musher, was training a team of dogs for a long-distance musher up there. And he had this bunch of puppies that he was training. And one day he asked me just to follow him on the snow machine, just in case. So I'm following along, and Mike stops his team and walks back to where I was at on the snow machine and says, come up here and step on the brake for me. So I stood up, and I'm standing on the brake on the sled with these eight little more than yearlings up there that he'd been training all winter long. And he reached down, he pulled the hook out of the snow, put it in the holster, and said, "Don't let go of the sled." And that was pretty much my introduction to running a team, and had just a wonderful time, and pretty much decided, this is what I want to do.
You know, Swati, that's about the same story on how I got started years ago. I went down to look at a couple of Siberian puppies when I was just starting college. And I went to the kennel, and it was in Georgia, so not a lot of snow there. And the breeder said, "Do you want to go for a ride on the cart?" And, boy, she hooked up a team of dogs. She let that break go, and we were off down the trail. And I was hooked just like you were.
Well, it doesn't take a whole lot. I love dogs. I love history. And mushing, especially these old school types of dogs, lets me experience a little bit of both. So it's great.
Right, right. Well, let's talk a little bit, before we start talking about some stories and some historical stuff, let's talk about these old school type dogs. You know, when people think about mushing, first off, most of the folks that listen to our show are just fans of dog mushing or fans in dog and of dogs in general. So they think sort of the way a sled dog should look should be looking like, you know, the dogs in the movies, the Siberian Huskies with the, you know, the fluffy fur and the pointed ears and, you know, the curly tail and all that. But most of them don't know that today's sled dog looks much different with the Alaskan Huskies. They have a lot of pointer in them. They're a lot shorter hair. Of course, they're much faster. But I am fascinated by the old school dogs. So tell us what you're talking about there in regards to the dogs that you like to run.
Okay. The historical types of dogs, their ancestors were basically either the Inuit dogs or the Indian dogs of the 18th and 19th century. They were indigenous to North America. Almost all had the pointed tails, the double coat, all of those traits that we associate with the Siberian Huskies and particularly the modern Alaskan Malamutes. They tend to be larger than the very fast, very durable modern racing dogs. They really are the kind of dogs that most casual followers of the sport would associate with being sled dogs. When I do some commercial touring as a contractor to a local tour operator, and our guests tend to gravitate toward my teams just because they are what folks expect to see when they think of a sled dog.
Now, these dogs that that you have in your kennel, did you raise them as pups? And if so, what type of dogs are they? And what are you looking for in this sort of old school dog? Are you looking for size? Are you looking for stamina? Are you looking for habitability, meaning getting along with each other? What are you looking for in your yard, Swanee?
Well, I'm looking for all of those things. I'm also looking for dogs that are as close to as I can find to the historical descriptions of Native American or First Nations dogs that were referred to historically as the Indian dogs. And that's because most of the Northwestern fur trade was conducted in the interior, and those were the dogs that were most readily available to the Northwest Company, XY Company, and Hudson's Bay Company traders. Probably the best description was the description that was provided by Robert Kennicott in the 1860s, who described them as very much like a fox, only larger and stronger in every way. So I'm looking for the Spitz types dogs. Mine run generally between about 50 and 80 pounds, so they are larger. They're very rangy dogs. They're long, they're leggy, and they're very capable dogs. They're very strong. They'll work for me all day long. You know, give them a good meal and a good night's sleep, and they'll do that day after day after day, just like they did in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Right. Well, let's jump on over to what I'm really interested in talking to you about today is your historical reenactments that you take part in. I know I've been looking over your Facebook page, and I love the outfits that you have on, and you really capture the essence of sort of an old school Alaskan, and you know, as a musher, and how they you know, how most people would see somebody in that form. How did in the world did you get started in that, and what, you know, what kind of stories do you tell at these events? Where are these events held and that sort of thing?
There are not a lot of historical reenactments in Alaska. We do have some historical rendezvous. Probably three of the really most popular ones each year. Over Memorial Day weekend, there's one that's usually in the Mattsu Valley. Our Alaska State Rendezvous can be almost anywhere in the state. That's a week-long event. And we have a fall rendezvous also that attracts a fair number of participants. And most of us are trying to accurately portray frontiersmen that were working and living in the frontier during, well, in between the 18th century and about 1841. And 1841 was the last year that the Free Trapper Rendezvous of the Rocky Mountains was held. So
right.
That's the time frame that most reenactors are working with. I specialize in the Northwestern or the Canadian fur trade from about the end of the French and Indian War, which was 1763. And for my mushing goals, I'm trying to be able to reenact pretty much any period of dog mushing history through 1963, which was about the time that the modern snow machine was becoming reliable enough to start replacing dog teams.
Right, and a little perspective for our listeners, that's about 10 years before the modern Iditarod. There was still lots of mushing going on throughout the state, and for folks that don't know, a lot of times these fur trappers and mail carriers and the sort would do their trade by day, and then, of course, they would all get together and race their dogs on the weekend, you know, friendly competitions going from village to village and that sort of thing. Am I right on that, Tom?
Yeah, very much so. There's some interesting accounts of people who were traveling together that basically it turned into a race. I mean, frontiersmen were extremely athletic, and they were a pretty competitive and macho lot. Anytime you have two teams on the same trail, you can almost call it a race because everyone
right.
wants to know who has the strongest or the fastest dogs on the trail. So I believe that sled dog racing probably started out as a bet, but a wager between two Canadian voyageurs who just decided that for grins and giggles, we're going to see who actually has the fastest team at this particular, and that was a long time ago.
So let's talk a little bit about that. You had talked about, the 1800s up till, you know, closer towards modern day where sled dogs were still used primarily as transportation here in the north. Can you kind of give us a rundown of the day in the life of a dog musher back then? I'm sure it's a little bit different than it is today, isn't it?
Well, a little bit. Their days started before the sun came up, and generally they were awake. They were in a camp in the middle of absolutely nowhere in miserable weather. Their sleeping gear consisted of a couple of really good wool blankets. They had good equipment for the technology of the day. They're shaking out of their blankets, they're gathering up their dogs, and things are getting kind of loud and noisy. Throwing everything on the sled, tying it down, and then with anywhere from two to four dogs pulling the sled, they took off running down the trail. It really wasn't until late in the 19th century that people finally figured out that if you ride on the sled, you can actually go faster than if you're running with the team and the load. But keep in mind, they had a limited number of dogs for the most part. They were only running teams of four dogs most of the time. The biggest team that I can document based on primary sources prior to about 1860 or so was a team of six dogs. And that team of six dogs along with was sent from one trading post to another on the mission to fetch back the body of a trader who had died and was reputed to be a very portly gentleman.
Interesting story.
Thus requiring a larger team of dogs. But, you know, today
right.
most of us consider a six-dog team to be a relatively small team. We don't think of being a big team of dogs until we get up around eight dogs or so.
Right. That's what I was getting ready to say, Swami, is, when I take out a small team like that, and I'm not a svelte guy myself, but when I take out four or six dogs, it feels like I'm barely moving down the trail. So I can only imagine, you know, what they were doing with a full sled of whatever they were carrying, whether it be supplies or mail or in that case, a body. But boy, those dogs must have been some powerful dogs compared to what we have today.
Compared to what we have today, I would argue that dogs of comparable size, I frequently, when I'm doing commercial tours, I'm running the same eight-dog team that I would run recreationally. So I have two average-sized Americans in the sled, and we're putting in a 6 to 8 hour day all day long, and the dogs are working just as well all day long as they were back then with about the same load.
Wow. Interesting. So you had mentioned that these trappers and voyagers and whatnot that were running up and down the trails, were they primarily going from point A to point B down a trail for several days, or was it more of an up and back? And the reason I ask that, if we think about some of the modern roadhouses down here in the Mat-Su area, like, for example, Yetna Station and Squetna, which is about, 30 miles or so, would that be a typical day for these guys, or would they go up and back, or how did they do things back then?
It really depended on the mission at hand. A lot of the work that was happening between trading posts was transporting goods one direction and furs the other. They might be going to a native camp that would be a couple of hundred miles away, and that would be a 3 or 4 day trip. A lot of it depended on trail conditions, just as it does today. If they had two dogs, they were probably hauling somewhere between 150 and 250 pounds on the sled. And they were basically traveling at a human pace. So how fast can you run on snowshoes? And
right.
It's really not how fast can I run on snowshoes, but how fast could that voyageur who spent his whole life doing physical work for a living run on voyageur on snowshoes? And he could go a lot further and a lot faster than I could under the same conditions.
Right. You know, when I think about this, Swanee,
here's a really good example.
Oh, go ahead.
The Winter Express was essentially a mail run, and it started at the furthest post that had been established at the time, and it had to arrive at Grand Portage about the 1st of March. Those teams averaged about 40 miles a day, and that's about what I expect of my dogs on any given working day. But that was 40 miles a day every single day.
Right.
One of the longest trips that I can document historically was about 130 miles. It was done in a single day. And he was carrying mail. This was in the 1880s. And he was traveling basically from a couple of church missions back to, I think it was in the Calgary area. He had considerable incentive to finish that trip as quickly as possible because he wanted to be back for his sister's wedding. And the reason that the wedding was so important to him was because they were actually going had alcohol that they could serve. And the poor guy hadn't had a drink in quite a long time because Hudson's Bay Company was actually very stingy with alcohol at that time.
And he was carrying back alcohol in the sled?
No, he was carrying the mail, but he wasn't going to get a drink if he wasn't back in time for the wedding.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I have a question for you in regards to how these guys ran up and down the trail, and I didn't mean to interrupt you there a minute ago, but were these guys sort of the truck drivers of the north, sort of how they're lined out today, where were they running from point A to point B with their employer's load and then coming back on a different, possibly a different employer's load on the way back, or was it all, were they all running for the same company all the time for these folks that work for other people?
No, they work for the same company. The voyageurs that were employed by the Northwest Company and the XY Company were primarily French Canadian. Most were recruited in the Montreal area. And then later in the trade, they were the Métis or the mixed blood progeny of marriages between the fur traders and Native or First Nations people. They were transportation specialists. During the summertime, they earned their living as being canoe motors. And then during the winter, they earned it running dogs and hauling the goods for that particular company. The Hudson's Bay Company recruited primarily in Scotland, Wales, and the Orkney Islands. So their people were where the French Canadians grew up, literally from childhood, running dogs. The Hudson's Bay Company people really didn't become familiar with driving dogs until they entered the fur trade at 16 or 17 years of age. So the Nor'westers really had an advantage on the trails just because their people were more experienced.
Right.
And
okay,
most of
next
their trails
question
consisted
here.
Of rivers.
I was just going to say, I was just going to ask my next question here. I'm just making sure I get everything in before we run out of time here. But this is my next question is something I do not know much about. Do you know when women first started getting involved with this, or did they? I mean, you'd mentioned all the way up through the 60s. Were women ever involved in this type of freighting or carrying of goods and services down the trail with a dog team?
Not that I can document in the historical trading companies, Northwest Company, the Hudson's Bay Company. Women played a very important role. They were almost exclusively Native American or First Nations women who were married to the fur traders. And they did have some really important roles, but I don't find any primary documentation to support that they were running teams of dogs, at least hauling freight.
Right.
They were probably using a couple of dogs to haul water, to haul wood. One of their jobs was to dress and process first to prepare them for shipment outside. So they probably had to haul those furs and those hides some relatively short distances. And certainly they were very strong, very athletic women. But I just don't see any primary documentation to support them as mushing sled dogs. Perhaps the exception of Native American or First Nations women who probably did run and handle teams. I just can't prove it. I can't point to a document and say, here is a firsthand account of this happening.
Right. So Swanee, you'd mentioned that you first got involved with mushing just about 11 years ago or so when you were out there with your buddy with his team. Was this whole history thing an interest to you before, or was this something you just sort of jumped in with 2 feet in the last, you know, 8 or 9 years or so and really took a hold of it?
No, I've been a student of fur trade history since the bicentennial, since about 1976. And I've been specifically interested in the Canadian fur trade since about 1989. That I've taken to really seriously studying the primary documents that are available. And a primary document is a first-hand recording or a first-hand account. It could be a newspaper article. A lot of what we have from the fur trade were business records from the Northwest Company or the Hudson's Bay Company. It is a document that was recorded at the time of the event.
Right. So, Swati, where do you go for your sources? Do you go to, like, the university library there in Fairbanks? Do you do a lot of your research online? Do you have a large library at your home? How do you get all this stuff lined out so you can do some research?
Well, Google today is very much your friend. When I first started, of course, the Internet wasn't nearly the resource that it is today. And it took me quite a while, but the Rasmussen Library's Polar Studies Department is just a phenomenal source of primary documents. So I spent years checking out books. They have some books that I'm the only one that's checked out in 40 years.
Wow.
But it's just an incredible resource for any student of North American history. It's awesome. Now I can find a lot of stuff, especially in Google Books, because most of those are books, the free ones, are books in which the copyright expired. And, of course, today copyrights don't expire.
Right.
So there's that becomes a really nice resource because I don't have to travel to find it. I don't have to pay money to find it. I can just download it, read it, take notes, refer back to it. And so that's been incredibly valuable to me.
Right. Well, we have about 2.5-3 minutes left, Swati, and I want to make sure we get in to talk a little bit about your blog, which is a pretty cool site for folks to visit. But my next and, I guess, last question here to you is, well, I guess it's more of a statement, and maybe you could comment on it, but there doesn't seem to be a heck of a lot of folks out there that are doing this type of research anymore. You know, nowadays, it's a different ball of wax in the universities. People aren't necessarily doing anthropological type research in this field, at least that I'm aware of. I wonder how come that is. Do you know?
I think it's because people are busy. People that have an interest in dog mushing or running dogs, and it takes a lot of time. It just takes a lot of time to do in-depth research. And when you're starting your day at 5 in the morning, feeding by 6 on the trail by 8, you're getting back, it's late at night, you still have to feed, water, and scoop the dogs. I think people just don't have the time to dedicate to it.
Point for sure. And I know as a student in college myself, returning to school in midlife and also trying to keep a dog yard going, it does take a lot of time, and I get a lot of sleepless nights out there, and I'm sure you do as well with your team. So lastly here, Swati, how can folks find out about you? Tell us a little bit about your blog and how often you post there, and do you take suggestions for stories or posts where you can research and find answers to?
Oh, man, that's a tough one, because if I start researching for other people, I'm going to lose track of the research I'm trying to do for myself. I'm willing
right.
to entertain suggestions. My blog, you can Google up Old School Alaskan Blog, and so far that'll come up first on the Google search list. I don't post nearly as frequently as I used to because now, of course, I have my team that requires me to be up at 6, feeding at 6:30, on the trail at 10, you know, and so forth. But I have been posting on the blog for years and years, and if you go back through the archives on the blog, I think you'll find some interesting information.
Right, and we'll definitely post links over on your show page when we put that up. But, you know, one of the reasons I contacted you for an interview is I've been following you on Facebook for quite a while now, several years, and I love your commentary back and forth on all sorts of topics regarding mushing, whether we're talking about Iditarod or, you know, just sort of mushing history and all sorts of things. You lend such a great perspective, and I really appreciate that, and I want to thank you, at least on my side, and for folks that follow you on Facebook. I'm sure they love to hear your commentary as well. So I definitely want to thank you for that, Swanee.
I'm don't know what to say. Now I'm blushing. I'm old, I'm opinionated, and I'm not afraid to put my opinion out there. Thank you. I take that
excellent,
as a compliment.
Excellent. Well, keep up the great work. I look forward to reading your stuff for a long time to come. And now that we have you on the show, maybe we can have you back on again and talk about some of these other stories. I had no idea that you were such a plethora of information from these old school stories. And I would love to have you back and maybe dedicate, you know, an episode or two about some of these longer stories that we could tell.
It would be my pleasure.
Thank you very much. Our guest today was Tom Swan. He goes by Swanee. I'll definitely put a link to his webpage or his blog page on his show page. And again, thank you, Swanee, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
You bet. You have a great evening.
Thank you very much. On behalf of my guest today, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Did you know that Alaska Dog Works trains service dogs for those in need throughout North America? Each and every service dog that is trained through the Lead Dog Service Dog Program and Michelle Forto and her team has an individual training plan. We train for autistic, mobility, psychiatric, and PTSD for our soldiers for service work. If you know of someone that may need a service dog, please take a moment and check out Alaska Dog Works on social media and at alaskadogworks.com. Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.